You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon, you're listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and today I'm bringing you interviews, performances, and stories from Detroit, Michigan, as part of the summer-long Praxis Summer Roadshow. I spent 6 days of the roadshow in Detroit last week, the longest continuous time in one city, and I loved it. Obviously, a person can't absorb a place in a few days, and this is especially true with Detroit, as its long history is slowly supplanted with a tale of supposed renaissance mixed with a gentrification story and racial tension from beyond just this one city. A highlight of the trip was the Sidewalk Festival of the Performing Arts, which you can find information about at www.sidewalkdetroit.com. I saw so many amazing performances there, but wanted to share this spoken word and musical piece titled I Can't Breathe by Jessica Kerr Moore. Moore is joined by Wendell Patrick and Ursula Rucker for the performance. You can find more of her work and information about this collaboration at Jessica Kerr Moore, that's MOORE.com.
It's scary to get pulled over, you know, like something simple like not putting on your turn signal, right? You can end up dead. Is it 2015? Let me get a poem, it's long. I wrote this originally for Eric Garner. Too many of these names. I'm in Detroit. I'm in Chicago. I'm in Brooklyn. I'm in St. Louis. I'm in Atlanta. I'm in Compton. I'm in Detroit. And I can't breathe. I can't breathe. The air is being sucked out of my city. The poor don't have water. And everything new means no us. I can't breathe. There is a smoking gun down my throat. With promises of a post-racial America, I can't swallow the chamber. It is stuck in 1967, and it keeps reloading. It keeps reloading after it pierces the bodies of our unarmed babies. I can't breathe. Because I'm being rushed on a sidewalk in the middle of a peaceful protest by a militarized police force in Missouri. They are yelling, I got one, I got one. I am half-running, distraught. So she puts her left hand. Rosa is a few steps behind. The air is thick and ugly and dense, and I can't breathe because now I'm being forced to lie face down on the cement in Ferguson with an AR-15 pointed at my back. A long brown teenage boy is shaking in Rosa's lap. A young thick girl stands up anyway. I call her back down and ask her to please wait. In Atlanta, a beautiful young activist tells me she is arrested at 6 p.m. and driven around by officers till 2 a.m. before finally being booked with no explanation. We know who you are, they say, hoping to replace her breath with fear. And now she doesn't know how to tell her story of being kidnapped. She can't breathe. She can't breathe. Who can push out fresh air in this country anymore? The rich? The corporation? We should all be choking to death from Fox News and processed foods, white supremacy, and what the hell is going on with Doc Lemon? He needs to hit the weed. Only he can smell, obviously, through that digital screen. My 19-year-old son calls me after hearing I'm in Ferguson to say, can you please go home? Can you please go home? And he hasn't lived with me in years, so I'm trying to figure out the geographic location of that place, home. The place we feel the safest. And I'm wondering where all this rage has been. I'm confused because when you acknowledge race, you're called a racist. Mississippi, goddamn, Missouriville, how did you? On Canfield, this young man smiles his gold at me. Beautiful and bright and bravado. You from Detroit. You a poet. I saw you on the news. This is a place for Mike Brown's blood turned to roses. The stem legs of my boys long and racing and always swimming toward the sun. Easily tripped up, light interrupted. The ones who don't love you are armed. As much as we claim this is our land, the world minority is running our country. Our sweat, our women, our mothers, we birthed this nation, built it on free labor and death with no reparations ray in sight. insight. I need more insight on what this has to do with genocide. Everything, 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 everything. We are here without choice. Many of us fatherless, some of us warm-blooded, West African, Dakota, Cree, Cherokee. We are a place for no place. We are natives, beautiful somewhere people, news flag poles and crosses, and so many more little girls. Plus those four you will never forget. We are Moors. We were traded whores, beggars. We the children of royalty. We black clay goddesses. We sound our forests. We the trees that bring the stories. I can't breathe. I'm home. From a terrifying place, and Octavia Butler, past future, past life scar resurfaced. I can't breathe, cause my son King is 4 years from 12, and the park is his own planet, where he plays freely and knows the seeds and flowers if you plant it. And he loves Bob Marley, Faith Ringo, and Frida Kahlo. Walks with his head up and doesn't follow. Recites Baraka, sings the blues. He thinks wearing a belt is cool. He is simply a black boy with an imagination built on a nation of poems, and the mom says, don't mess with me. Cable is a winter luxury, so we don't get our info from the idiot box. Still, I've already had to teach my son how to act when we are pulled over by the cops. He sings and waves and like my poems. He sings them black and flirt and asks to call me on the phone. He sings them white in Dearborn Heights, asking me, accusing me of running a light. I did not run. Mommy, but the policeman is lying. Yeah, that's the reality too, son. When I can't breathe, I cry in a parking lot, dropping you off at hockey camp, praying the white coaches and white kids won't try to suck the beauty out of your lungs. Pray you black ice skate fast, past the chokeholds, the dangerous walks from the store to buy candy. I can't breathe, I can't breathe, so I rush to get you from school daily. A collective mother's intuition always feels death moving round this winter in America clock. In these spaces where the air is thin, humanity is forgotten. An ancestral spirit is blowing hard, and fear has pushed you to a place you don't recognize. A forced language is pushed into your mouth, ripped across your back, along the Ivory Coast, on the ship called Jesus, in the Congo, through the door of no return, in the Alabama cotton fields, in Chicago, in Cleveland, in Staten Island, when you look the world in its face. After attempting to hijack your spirit, takes your breath loosely for Lucy, I will inhale God and blow my last wind into your body. Your exhale be the Holy Ghost. Your exhale be the Holy Ghost. But this land, I can't breathe. 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 I can't breathe.
Again, that was Jessica Care Moore, Ursula Rucker, and Wendell Patrick performing I Can't Breathe at the Sidewalk Festival of the Performing Arts in Detroit, Michigan. You can find links to this collaboration and the rest of Jessica's work at jessicacaremoore.com. Police violence has been arguably the topic of the summer, brought up wherever I've gone in both the U.S. and Canada. I was able to talk with former Praxis guest Peter Werby about his 50 years in anarchist publishing with the Fifth Estate and the ways that our current era both mirrors and differs from the 1960s.
I'm Peter Werby, and I'm a longtime staff member of the Fifth Estate magazine. And the Fifth Estate is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year, 50 years of publishing. It's one of the longest, if not the longest, publishing anarchist newspaper in American history. I also professionally work on the radio as a talk show host and an interviewer.
Great. And so Let's talk about, so 50 years at Fifth Estate, how many of those years have you been involved for?
49.
Wow. So we're talking about the 60s, right? And you said, and you pointed out those 7 years. Obviously, I think everyone thinks that their own time when they're coming of age is important because they are important during that time. But, so the last 7 years since I graduated from high school, right, has been the kind of kicked by the financial crisis in 2008, housing and everything. We're looking at going on 15 years of embroilment in Afghanistan, 13 in Iraq, student debt hitting $1 trillion, all of these things, Black Lives Matter, like erupting recently, people finally talking about police violence. Part of the reason I'm traveling this summer is because I think that we're in kind of one of these moments that's not dissimilar to the 60s that you pinpoint, you know, 65 to 72. What do you think about that in terms of, especially as someone who's getting stories from all over the place for this magazine, where do you think we're at?
Well, it's always hard to tell, of course, but I'm hoping it's 1964, if you get my meaning, because there were things that happened even among white students and white activists beginning in the late 1950s. And there were things like the free speech movement at Berkeley, and I think it was 1964. Mm-hmm. And there were certainly a lot of whites that were involved in the civil rights struggles, and many like Black activists paid with their lives. And this has all begun to percolate. I mean, the greed and the psychopathology of the people running the system is so out of control. You would think if someone said, hey, you could run this system and still maintain your dominant position, have all this money, have all this power, you could do a lot better than this, and so could I. Because you'd figure, you know, we got to treat people a little better than this. And so it's very possible that we could be on the edge of an explosion. Because like when you got into the 80s, it seemed like nothing was happening. And a lot even in the 90s. And then all of a sudden you have something like Seattle in 1999, and there's this big explosion. Hey, one of the things I wanted to say that I didn't finish, and my on-air partner would have corrected me, I said by 1972, all of the so-called underground papers of that era, the 500 regularly appearing ones, there are hundreds more that would publish one and two issues. There was GI papers in the armed services, high school papers, labor, you know, caucus papers and all that. They all peeled off and all dropped out except for the Fifth Estate. And it was because we came upon these anarchists and what we called ultra-left ideas that so ignited our sense of what was happening in society. I mean, the movement of opposition had all but collapsed, but we were all of a sudden taken with these ideas of why this was all happening. And so it was a real coincidence of time and who we met and the ideas that we came across that were pretty unique. A lot of them were the situationists, and then tying our greater knowledge to what happened in Paris in 1968, the works of Freddie Perlman and a number of other kind of obscure writers, Jacques Camat, Jean Baudrillard, people like that. And we also just had a group called the Eat the Rich Gang. And we took over the Fifth Estate. The Fifth Estate had almost turned into a commercial weekly, you know, where they had taken cigarette ads and X-rated movie ads. And we took it over and we said, boom, no more ads, no more salaries. We're going to operate this collectively. And we're going to come out monthly instead of weekly. And it's worked out. We're here 50 years later.
Yeah. And so I'm really interested. You have two shows coming up in Detroit, at the Detroit Historical Museum and the MoCab, Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit.
Right.
Nice, I got it. And so those are both 50-year retrospectives,
right,
which is pretty impressive for any type of publication. How does it feel as an anarchist working with an anarchist publication, usually a pretty universally maligned group of people in society? Like, how does that feel to have not one but two museums saying, like, yes, we acknowledge that this has been important work and we want to showcase it?
Well, first off, I think maybe we're not dangerous. Maybe we're not frightening, or dangerous enough or frightening enough. And we've had some criticism, people saying, how can you show your stuff there? You are affirming these institutions that decide what is art, what is good art and what isn't. And I guess I think that it's a manner in which we can extend the Fifth Estate and its visibility all the more. Detroit Historical Museum is going to be a lot more radical nostalgia. But at the end, they say, yeah, you know, it's an anarchist publication. It quotes the FBI as saying the Fifth Estate supports revolution everywhere. And one of the graphics is my FBI file where it shows got a little bit describing me. And we used to laugh at that when we got our FBI files back in what was called the Red Squads from the Michigan State and Detroit Police. But I was looking at one, and it said previous addresses, and it had my addresses back till I was 8 years old. And you think nothing happened, and so being white and middle class, I'm pretty safe from the kind of repression. But societies can turn a corner, and so you have this Stasi mechanism that could at any minute know exactly where I am, know who my friends are. I think sometimes, what if I really had to go on the lam like radicals have in other countries? Yeah, I can do this now. Think about this. And, I'm this big radical anarchist, right? Except I have, I'm able to put my ideas forth on commercial mainstream radio. Mm-hmm. We're having mainstream institutions celebrate our existence. So there's not much of a risk. I wonder, and I think a lot of people do, I wonder what would happen if the risk was getting your fingernails pulled out or having your family killed or killed yourself. Would I still be like this? I'm just always amazed at the bravery of people in totalitarian countries.
Hard totalitarian.
Yeah.
Soft.
Yeah. Rather than, you might, get... bonked on the head by a cop if you're demonstrating against the G20, which isn't very much fun. But if you think of, if you're in Burundi, you're going to wind up dead, or all of a sudden you're tied up and some really horrible man comes in to do some awful things to you.
Yeah.
So you asked what's my reaction. It's a little mixed, but mostly pretty positive. The MOCAD one is we're holding back no punches. I mean, it's going to be, it's going to have all our themes about the effects of industrialism and a petrochemical nuclear society, what it does to the planet, the condemnation of capitalism and the political state. And so they're just, they're pleased as can be. And it might be right that we represent no challenge or no threat, or probably if we did, we wouldn't be able to do it, right? But you never can tell. Just like now, our opposition to the worst abuses of this society, we're pretty much allowed to go along without the state being really repressive. But you think back in the 60s where, what was done to the Black Panthers or what was done to blacks and whites of the Civil Rights Movement, I mean, those were threats to the point where they had to start killing people in opposition. And we're not there yet.
Which,
being celebrated.
Sandra Bland, and many of these Black Lives Matter activists, I just saw some leaked files, similar files from municipal police departments in cooperation with the FBI that classify these people. It's interesting to see now, it's like, this is this person's Twitter handle, and they have this many followers.
Wow.
And that is what makes this person a threat at high level. But then the threat, they classify them as a physical, which is very interesting, these like Black activists. So I was looking at these files, and there's a bunch because people got a hold of them, and it's all about what's their impact on social media and like what are their ideas.
Well, if this is 1964, as I said, they want to be ready for 1965 when things explode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there hasn't been, I don't think there's ever been this challenge to police violence, which is an inherent part of policing. It has been since the first police forces were formed, like in the 1830s. And they say, oh, it hasn't been this anti-cop since the 1960s. Well, I don't think it's, people obviously saw the police pretty much as the violence at demonstrations. And there was a little about the day-to-day policing, but now it's all about, how do the police function? And, that the police are, so heavily armed. I mean, a guy just in your neck of the woods, pardon me, that guy, what's the town where he was, he had a rock, so they shot at him
Pasco.
They shot him at him 17 times, and they said, they've determined he did have a rock. Yeah, all right, somebody's got a rock, let's shoot him 17 times. I mean, that, but part of it is the cop armaments. Part of it is, the NRA has made sure there's so many guns in society. Mm-hmm. Cops probably are nervous, and there usually are, so many of them are racist. So many, I mean, how many of them are suffering from PTSD because of these Iraq veterans and all of that?
Especially private security.
Yeah.
Actually, has a huge.
How many of them just hate the poor because it's part of that whole authoritarian personality? Mm-hmm. So I don't know what can be done.
Yeah.
I mean, as long as you have this enormous and increasing population of poor people, and particularly people of color, and heavily armed cops, you can have all the, the body cameras and cruiser cameras. I mean, this guy, what, he's on cruiser camera and he shoots this guy in the head?
Just recently.
Yeah. Right.
It's,
in Memphis.
Well, and part of it, I think, has to do with it's the psychology that you were talking about before, that as long as people feel that, these people are here to protect us, and that must have been a bad guy. People are willing to justify a lot of it for the feeling of being safe.
Sure.
And it's not insignificant that the police violence movement's being led by people, by black people, who have culturally not ever felt that way about the police.
Right.
Because their parents were there in the 60s and 70s, and it's always
been
this way.
And in the
20s,
and in the 30s, and 80s, 90s,
exactly, all the way back.
All, yeah.
So that's significant, and it's something that I think is starting to, I can have much more coherent conversations with white people in progressive circles than I could a few years ago about, like, ACAB, why would you say that? That's not fair. There's good cops. And it's like, sure, there are kind individuals who have the best of intentions, but how are they supposed to subvert this kind of a culture that they have to work in?
And
they're going to get fired.
And basically, when you talk about the good cops, even the cops, there are a lot of cops that never even unholster their guns.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them never even fire a shot in their whole career.
Mm-hmm.
And you start, the real violence is pretty much constrained to a small, not real small, but a fairly small percentage of the overall force. But these guys, the nice guys, the good cops, the ones that don't want to beat people up and aren't looking for people to beat up and arrest unfairly and all that, they know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And they're complicit in it. Because one of the things is, these cops, the real violent ones, they're the ones that when there's somebody that has to be arrested and really is resisting, or there's somebody in a house that's armed, these are the psycho nutcase cops that are going to go in there, that are going to, go in and subdue somebody that, very frequently people that are mentally ill and are, acting out rage.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ever look, in fact, one of the things I tell my listeners is, when the people say, well, there's a few bad apples, I said, Google police violence. I mean, and if you say, oh, these are just reports, I said, go to videos. It's astounding. I said, don't do it if you're a sensitive person, because it is incredible what the images that are on there. And I said, if you say, well, you didn't see what happened before. I said, look at some of those and tell me what you could imagine happened before.
That justifies.
Yeah, that justified, a handcuffed woman being, face down, being stomped in the head.
Mm-hmm.
I said, tell me what that is, all about. So, the point being, though, look at any police violence video. And, not every one of them, but very frequently you'll see these cops, four or five of them beating the crap out of somebody who's on the ground, and then there'll be a bunch of cops standing around. Eric Garner, take a look at that video again. And, and what usually was these guys, there's a whole bunch of guys standing there, and this big man, Eric Garner, is saying, leave me alone, stop bothering me, I'm just trying, And then all of a sudden, here comes this guy, I forgot his name now, the cop, who has a whole history of violence, has lawsuits against him. He just comes in and bam. And he's like, in, I don't know if you know much about hockey, but he's like the enforcer. Mm-hmm. He's the poop kicker. I don't know what you can say on your radio.
We'll edit it.
Yeah. So most of them, they're just, you know, hanging out. They don't want to, they don't even, because you wind up, you smack people in the face, you cut your hands, you break your fingers. And what they want to do is, but, so they're letting the, they're enabling the violent cop. So it's a violent system and has nothing to do with this good cop or bad cop.
Yeah. So do you think, and we only have a few minutes because I want to respect your time, what do you want people to know or to think about Fifth Estate or about anarchism in general?
Well, anarchism contains a vision that's diametrically opposite to how we live in this society, and it's about balance. And I've been influenced some because I've been taking Tai Chi for years about harmony and the Tao Te Ching, which is this text that talks about the idea of natural harmony. And when man enters the world with intention and has a gender, I use the gender on purpose, it's that with these great intentions, everything gets screwed up. And there is a natural harmony that always existed between people till men got these great schemes of gods and rulers and wealth and domination and conquest and all of that. And anarchism negates that. Anarchism says we're all family and that we ought to relate to one another. Well, not the authoritarian family, but that where everyone has everyone holds hands. That if we actually could diagram pre-state societies and how now I think anarchists would like to be, is that everyone would be holding hands. Everything, the natural world, everything in the natural world, the so-called inanimate objects, trees and stones and rivers and what have you. And that would be a harmony. Whether it's possible, given the damage that capitalism and the state has done, I'm sometimes discouraged about. But anarchism is also a personal philosophy, is how does one navigate in the world? Even though one may be a privileged person like myself, a white middle-class American, it's hard for me, impossible for me to live while other people are suffering or while nature is suffering. So that impels me to act in terms of a vision where we all hold hands.
It's a really good description.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how can people find the magazine?
Probably these days, particularly since we're recording this in Detroit and you're going to broadcast this in Spokane, they can go to fifthestate.org, fifthestate.org. And if they want to hear my radio program, you can do that via the internet. And you could go to Peter Werbe, WERBE.com.
You went into full radio mode right there.
WERBE.com.
Yeah, you got the cadence.
Yes.
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks for talking to me. It's been great to meet you in person.
Wonderful. Yeah. Same here.
Yeah.
That was Peter Werbe, editor at Fifth Estate, which you can find, as he said at the end there, at Fifth Estate, fifthestate.org. Locals can also contact me at praxis@kyrs.org, praxis@kyrs.org, for information about distribution in Spokane. Fifth Estate has been based in Detroit these past 50 years, and a lot has changed since then in the city. I want to be able to put the last decades of Detroit in perspective in a short amount of time, and to do that, I want to share a short article with you. And this is from The Guardian, by Brian Doucette. The title is Detroit's Gentrification Won't Give Poor Citizens Reliable Public Services. This talks a little bit about that balance between, like, what's development, what's revitalization, and what's gentrification. He says, for the past 2 years, I have taken postgraduate students in urban geography to Detroit, where a prosperous downtown is rising. The city's transformation is being celebrated and seen as a potential model for other places. But George Galster, professor of urban studies at Detroit's Wayne State University, told my students to imagine the city as a bathtub. The new investments and activities are like water pouring into the tub. but nothing has been done to plug the giant hole at the bottom of the tub. This new renaissance does not address why Detroit declined in the first place. It does little to address poverty, unemployment, and access to resources for the vast majority of the city's residents. What's worse, the gentrification of downtown Detroit contributes to greater inequality and polarization, which are growing challenges for cities around the world. What has created this hole at the bottom of the bathtub? Other than basic capitalism, of course. Not what he says, just my comment. Between 2000 and 2010, 25% of the population left the city. That's an average of 2,000 people a month. Half of its 5 to 9-year-olds departed during this time, their parents leaving in search of better schools and opportunities in the suburbs. Today, Motor City boasts just 2 vehicle assembly plants, down from more than 24 at its peak. Neighborhoods which used to house factory workers look like rural prairie. Adjusted for inflation, city tax revenue fell from $2 billion to $1.1 billion between 1960 and 2012. Retail is largely absent from Detroit. Even buying basics such as socks can require a trip to a suburban mall. This exodus of jobs has led to a mismatch of people and employment across the region. Around 60% of Detroiters who have a job work in the suburbs. Conversely, 70% of the jobs located in the city of Detroit go to people who live in the suburbs. Chronic unemployment and poverty remain one of the city's biggest challenges. The current renaissance does not address these problems. Most investment takes place in the greater downtown, which includes the city's historic core and neighborhoods such as Midtown and Corktown, which comprise 5% of the city area and population. Here, once abandoned offices are being bought up and renovated by enthusiastic entrepreneurs. A new modern tram line is being built along Woodward Avenue, and it can actually be difficult to find an apartment as vacancy rates are very low. The boundaries between revival and decay can be very severe. Travel 3 minutes by car from Midtown's Wayne State University, and you're surrounded by streets overgrown by vegetation and burned-out factories. The gentrified Corktown neighborhood, centered along Michigan Avenue, abruptly ends one block west of its famous Slow's Barbecue restaurant. Greater downtown's current revival will mean that this 5% of the city will pull further and further ahead of the other 95%. Those able to afford to live there enjoy great restaurants and bars, well-paid employment, safe and attractive neighborhoods, and reliable public transit. The problem is, most Detroiters cannot afford to live here. And like everything else in Southeast Michigan, race is one of the dominant factors. In a city that is 85% African American, Greater Downtown is becoming increasingly white. There are also growing divides between public and private services. While most Detroiters wait hours for the police to arrive, private security forces patrol downtown and around Wayne State University. When problems arise in adjacent neighborhoods, you don't call 911, you call campus police, who respond in minutes rather than hours. Detroit has some of the worst municipal services in the country, so the gentrifying areas increasingly turn to their own private amenities to compensate. New public transport investments are increasingly focusing on Detroit's core. There's a sad irony that in a city where about a quarter of residents are too poor to own a car, the new tram line will serve office workers, gentrifiers, and students in Greater Downtown. It will do nothing for the low-income families that need to travel 15 kilometers by bus to access a basic grocery store. So while there is indeed a renaissance taking place in Detroit, most city residents are detached from it. This inequality is part and parcel of contemporary cities. It is not confined to cities struggling with the legacy of deindustrialization. Polarization is also one of the biggest challenges facing prosperous cities such as London, New York, or Paris. But inequality doesn't just happen. It's the product of economic, business, and political decisions of what, how, and where to invest and distribute money and resources. The current revival of Detroit and cities like it, such as Glasgow or Newcastle, needs to be seen in this context. Detroit's safer, more attractive downtown contributes to growing inequality across the city. It does little to address the poverty, unemployment, poor health, and abandonment in 95% of the city. It promotes fragmentation and individualization. Why should downtown residents fight for better municipal services when they can buy their own private ones? Politicians and planners love a good success story, but cities are rarely so simple, and celebrating Detroit's current renaissance would be the wrong lesson to draw from this great American city. Again, that was Brian Doucette on The Guardian talking a little bit about this, the gentrification in Detroit and what it looks like. And it's really interesting. I was kind of in an area, for the most part, not in Midtown, Corktown, downtown, just outside. And I did some really interesting interviews that we don't have time to include in this show, but that will be included on my blog at truthscout.net, where I've been posting information about the whole show, with two of my hosts, who both kind of, two families, both fit into this category of people who have moved to the city in the past few years, but also not standard gentrifiers, and what that looks like, and what the ideas are at play there. So it's very interesting. It's definitely a great city, both the old parts that I saw, people I've talked to who have been there their whole lives, and both the kind of homegrown revival, a lot of people who did not leave, who are doing projects to contribute to the arts, to clean up. There's a lot of grassroots organizing, like you're about to hear about, that happens that doesn't get quite as much coverage as, like, hip businesses opening, as though that alone could revive a city. So, yeah, that's a common theme that I heard among residents both in this old and new Detroit. The need to look at where the city is now, at this moment, rather than looking either to a hypothetical future or waxing poetic about a now absent past. There are famously, as described in that article, entire blocks that have been razed, leaving empty lots sprinkled throughout neighborhoods, and one common use is urban farming, since there's also a distinct lack of food justice, a concept that will be explained in this interview, in Detroit. It seems like a really good response what to do with this space. So I talked with Anthony Haidinger, a farmer and organizer with CDC, Central Detroit Christian, and Ted Kaczerski, a permaculturist and educator who worked with Detroit Public Schools and now works with Anthony on sustainable protein production in the city. Here's what they had to say.
My name is Anthony Haidinger, and I'm a garden production coordinator at a faith-based nonprofit called Central Detroit Christian, CDC. Went to Michigan State, did horticulture and religious studies there, and the next plan is to work on building a sustainable protein farm with my partner over here.
Ted Kaczerski. I was been in Detroit going on 7 years now. Was a lot of things, production, farmer, educator, and project manager for Detroit Public Schools and their Farmer School program. I've recently left there and am now doing a multitude of things, working with Anthony at CDC, Forage Wild Foods for restaurants, and I'm working on a sustainable protein farm in the city.
Wow. So neither of you are from here, but you've obviously chosen here after 7 years. What's the process behind that? How'd you end up here?
I'm gonna start.
I grew up north of here and just always thought Michigan is kind of just the breadbasket, for lack of a better. Yeah, and then moved down to the city just because of it's the city, arts, music, whatever. And then went to school at Wayne State University, so that kind of kept me here, gave me some roots, and then was more politically active, and then just went to food straight away. Studied anthropology, so that's kind of a no-brainer there. But yeah, I've been growing in the city 5 years.
In a lot of similar ways, I knew that I wanted to stay in Michigan when I graduated, and to do what I wanted to do and to make the biggest impact that I can make with health disparities and food justice would be in Detroit, especially since everyone knows the issues, right? Mm-hmm. But you very rarely hear success stories or what the real struggles of the people are on the street. And especially growing up biracial and almost all white high school, all, you know, very, very similar in college, the type of atmosphere I was in, and I was ready to kind of get in touch with my roots. So I knew this was the place.
Can you, for the uninitiated in that, can you just talk a little bit about food justice? Like, that might be a term people aren't even familiar with, because it's not something we talk about. But
well, it's just, you know, I guess at its source, food justice, in my eyes, kind of describes all of the interrelated parts that create equity and freedom and sovereignty when it comes to our health, you know, dealing with food, because it's all about what you put in. So the justice aspects take on different forms as far as what access is to people, what is available to people, pricing, as well as the option to even know what is righteous for the body and soul. A lot of these issues become confounded in areas of poverty, especially in areas that have high segregation, like Detroit, and it's very easy to isolate people from the resources they need to survive if that's the whole goal, to oppress a culture of people, which the city has been doing since 1910s in different forms. And so in a modern sense, food justice, I mean, things have gotten so far removed, people are so far removed from any sort of ethos of love for their food or their environment in general, that we're in a place of complete brokenness, that we're starting at square one again. Nutrition education, you know, meal planning, farmers markets, trying to find all of these different ways to implement and educate people again about what real good food looks like. And especially in a city that has very few major grocery stores left, and where, especially in a neighborhood like this, liquor stores and convenience stores outnumber grocery stores 23-1, there's a huge disparity there, where a lot of times, especially confounded with our entitlement system, with, you know, our bridge cards or whatever food assistance benefits you may be on, it's very easy to stay clear from the righteous path, from the healthful path. And I think a lot of that, again, is intentional, but more so, we're at a place where people just don't even know what's available. And when you're trying to stretch that bottom dollar, you're going to buy what will feed your family. And usually that's not fresh produce, it's processed goods. And so trying to attack these different issues, I mean, food insecurity in general is another big part of food justice, but it's different in each community. I think Detroit has a lot of all of those issues combined and put into a space where it's almost unreal, like, compared to other major, you know, metropolises. At the same time, food justice has a big picture and role in Detroit with its urban agricultural scene. So there's over 1,500 community gardens, farms,
that's market gardens. That's a bigger number than I thought.
Oh, wow. It's huge. And that's only the people that are registered through a few organizations. There's a lot more guerrilla gardening and backyard stuff going on, foraging, like Ted was saying, wild animal husbandry. A lot of different things are kind of playing into what we look to see as a temporary, if not deeper, permanent solution for some of our food insecurity issues in a place that is very staggering health statistics. So, from the perspective that I come from, it's production education and just meeting people where they're at and trying to find out how to make simple solutions to get people eating right, or at least caring about what they're eating. But it goes a lot deeper than that. Part of that also is the reindustrialization of our, you know, of our food platforms in a way that is actually equitable for people and will actually create wealth. Because without that, there could be no political organization. There's no economic organization. And so I believe that a lot of these other things can be addressed once you're not scraping and scratching for a meal. Mm-hmm. You know, so.
Yeah. Does that kind of tie into your, like, anthropology background making its way to food?
Oh, too? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I didn't go too much further with it because I really wanted to see stuff on the ground. You know, I think that anthropology is very academic and very removed, very armchair, kind of theoretical, you know, stuff that I was not interested in. Maybe would have paid the bills a little easier, but know, I think like Anthony's saying, there's so many, this mosaic of all of these different things coming together that, yeah, absolutely, cross-culturally, in the dominant culture, you know, Western culture, we're going to call it, is very much, that's very much the case for many major cities, all the time. And I think, you know, this, right, it's a keyword, kind of post-industrial, you know, but that, I think to me, I started looking towards those, that equity disparity, and then also the health, like the health of the environment. Even though we are in a city, you know, this Detroit has a lot of wild space, which is one of those interesting things where we're in an industrial area with heavy, heavy contamination in a lot of places. So with food, you know, autonomy, you have to think about the health of the space actually itself. So I think, yeah, tying in the equity and then how we become healthy in like the biological sense again, like Michigan and this area at least is home to the most prolific biome in like the world, arguably. You know, we hosted the largest spread of mammals, larger mammals. It's like one of these places that just could jump back with an agricultural lean, you know. Mm-hmm. But we just gotta, yeah, so definitely anthropology led to that.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about the specific garden, farm, it's kind of right on the line, right, that you're working on?
Yeah, kind of. And then his projects are separate, so
oh, okay.
You can talk on
yeah.
his. But the ones that I work with are, it's about 3/4 acre combined. It's 2 market gardens, small hobby orchard, a greenhouse, and then externally we also have the city's only licensed fish farm. So we do urban aquaponics and an old liquor store. And all of our businesses, as part of a community development group, are neighborhood-based. So you have to live in our area, in our target zip codes that we serve, to be employed. And, you know, trying to bring that economic circle a little bit tighter and closer to the community in the same type of way all of the produce that we grow, distributed. We have a local produce market called Peaches and Greens. And so they also have a mobile truck. They do mobile farmers markets with that and street routes. And so about 3/4 of my food goes there. And the rest goes to other markets and some restaurants. For the fishery, similarly, we have a lot of residential sales. And then we're about to break into new trials of sprouts and trying to get fish and our herbs back into more of a restaurant scene and less of a residential retail scene. And that is, yeah, that's as of current, like what we're doing with CDC. And so the project started as community gardens, one in 2006 and one in 2009, and since they've become market gardens. But we're seeing more of an interest in people wanting to be part of more of an intentional community setting around agriculture. And so that's going to be negotiated also moving forward. How do you really tend these spaces in a way that drives people in, it attracts them in, instead of isolating them out. And so that's a whole nother it's yeah. a whole nother story.
Yeah.
But that's a snippet of the projects working on with CDC.
How about you?
So what I did with DPS was DPS had 3 prongs. One was
which stands for
Detroit Public Schools. Okay. Yeah, sorry. So yeah, DPS is the public school system here in Detroit. So it's been they have a two and a half acre production farm that I was at for the first year, and that is coupled with 80 individual school gardens. Those are more just raised bed, kind of more educational facets. And then there was another educational facet being the fresh fruit and vegetable program, where we do in class activities and just bring in fresh fruit from the farm, fresh vegetables from the farm, and as a snack and. So yeah, we would grow food to go right into the cafeteria. So that was, one site was the largest there implementing that. And then I had bottom line a project, more of like a hobby permaculture site. Hobby, I guess I mean in size. But we worked a lot with advancing water retention stuff, kind of looking towards how to grow a lot more food in a small space using 3-dimensional stuff, building up, you know, with our land and earthworks and, more perennial crop production. That's since I've left that, but then, yeah, that was what I did there.
Cool. been talking to a lot of permaculture people.
Is that right?
Yeah, I know a lot of people involved in that, and it's cool that it's so far diffused. It's good.
Yeah.
So we've just got a few minutes, really, because time just goes. What do you want people to know about urban farming? Like, what? Because obviously, it's something we need to be doing everywhere, like probably in every urban area on the planet, and just building up small farms and getting away from what we're doing now, industrial scale. It doesn't work. And where I live, we have dust storms because it doesn't work, you know? And what do you think people should know about it, if it's something they want to get involved in?
I mean, on a Detroit scale, it's very interesting. So as Ted was kind of speaking about, we have a lot of land. I mean, a good quarter of the city is vacant land, which to some people it has a very romanticized implication of just, you know, just great planning the city and producing a lot of food. But in reality, dealing with things like contamination, dealing with things just like the soil itself, the remediation of the soil, the resources available, and the potential for distribution through markets, it has to be urban in a sense that we are creating agriculture in places that is viable and not just on this. We're nowhere near saturation in this market, especially in the city, but we can see things are changing really quickly with the redevelopment. And so we're seeing, or what we're getting into and what some people are starting to move toward, is indoor, especially just because we know that as the city redevelops, there'll be less and less arable land that is available for people to use. In a more general sense, to delve into this, find your niche, whatever that may be, if it's your backyard, if it's working with people in the community, or if you want to be a larger scale producer, partner up with people, learn how to really engage the earth in the proper manner. And if it's something you want to get into as a lifelong career, be able to diversify your income, because it's not easy, and it, you know, vegetables don't pay well. But nonetheless, we have to have that spirit of cultivation within each and every one of us, like you're saying. I totally agree. On a viability standpoint, when it comes to finances, it's a tough sell. And that's because of where the market is, you know, pinched on at this moment in time. But I think as the industrial system that we know and have known, that our parents knew, starts to unravel, which it is, there will be much more of a demand for these types of things. But land being one of the, and water, of course, being the largest factors contributing to the success of any farming operation, it has to be done differently in a city. Mm-hmm. Whether that's indoors or rooftops or old warehouses, schools, and commercial spaces like we have here in the city in Detroit, or if it's done on much more of an incubator, educational type of space, there has to be innovators in the field that create economic success in these projects for it to become supported, whether civically or legislatively. Because as of now, the verdict is kind of, it's not out, but a lot of people have, you know, they're skeptical. Mm-hmm. We know it's necessary, but the value can't always be translated to the everyday consumer. Mm-hmm. So it's something just to be wary of, but 100% necessary.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say much more without echoing a lot. I mean, I just think that there's city planners and city officials that really, you know, don't give, when we were talking about this earlier today, don't give a damn about, you know, urban farming. I think, you know, Reverend Al Sharpton, green beans aren't going to save the city, you know? just, I love that quote. But no, I think what Anthony's saying is the cultivator and everybody is like, that's, we need to have that. And I think the urban plate is an interesting one. And we are, it's going to be slow. But again, I'm just echoing. But that's, I think those are all true points. So if someone wants to get into it, yeah, it's hard to wrap it into a nice sentence. But
yeah.
I think we've covered a lot.
Yeah. And is there anything else you want to add? How can people find out about these projects, like resources-wise, if they are local? Or even if they're not and they want to look at examples.
As far as resources for growing, just getting in touch, involved. I mean, most cities, a lot of cities have an urban agricultural ordinance now. Mm-hmm. And so that is a great beginning resource to finding out what specific regulations are there, what do you have to do as far as prepare your site in a certain way. Each city, everywhere I've been that I've witnessed urban agriculture happening as seen in a movement, they have their organizations that seem to be pretty good at distributing resources, but I mean, there's a number of online resources, at least just to find out more, like SARE, Sustainable Agriculture Resource Education Network, I think it is. There's SARE. That's a good one. Seedstock is an interesting website that does a lot of, webinars and blog posts about different urban ag going on around the country. That's a great place to find interesting projects, things to model, people to get in touch with. I really like that site. And every extension office that goes through any major university also has a lot of resources on just basic gardening, beginning farming, and or can get you in touch with an agent to kind of spec out what kind of project you want to do. In Detroit, it's nice because we have a lot of resources. Michigan State being so close, U of M, Wayne State, we have a lot of schools, and there's four others in the city, that all have different outreach, dealing with food justice, dealing with sustainable agriculture in their own ways. And so we're pretty fortunate that we have a vast network of academic and grassroots knowledge to what's happening. For the projects I'm part of, cdc.org, you can find out more about what we're doing there. And soon to be Detroit Ento, Detroit's first insect farm. That's what we're working on next. So I would stay tuned for that also. Yeah.
All right, that's all the time we have for today, but you've been listening to Praxis on KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Hope that you'll join me next Saturday at 4 p.m., where you'll hear more continued stories from the Praxis Summer Roadshow. I've been having a great time, and do send me any feedback you have. If you want to follow the podcast or contact me, you can do both at facebook.com/praxisradio. You can also email me at praxis@kyrs.org. Thanks for listening.